Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 50. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we begin this week's episode, I'd like to give my heartfelt thanks to the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so very grateful for your encouragement and immense generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. October's prize is a Tudor book bundle, kindly sponsored by the History Press. It contains three fabulous Tudor titles, Catherine Howard by Connor Byrne, Tudor Folk Tales by Dave Tong, and A History of the Tudors in 100 Objects by John Matusiak. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled to welcome back to the show Tony Mount to talk all about medieval and Tudor medicine. Tony is a history teacher, a writer, and an experienced public speaker. She describes herself as an enthusiastic lifelong learner and is a member of the Richard III Society Research Committee and a library volunteer where she leads the creative writing group. Tony has written a number of excellent books, including Everyday Life in Medieval London, The Medieval Housewife, and Medieval Medicine, Its Mysteries and Science. Coming out in paperback very soon is A Year in the Life of Medieval England. Tony has also created a range of online history courses for medievalcourses.com and is the author of a series of fiction books. My conversation with Tony straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, Tony. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Natalie.
It's so lovely to have you back on the show. Now, in August, we chatted about life in Tudor London. But since then, we've had lots of new listeners tune in and find the show. So it would be really great if you could introduce yourself again and tell us a little bit about your particular interests and your background.
Okay, well, I've been interested in history most of my life, but medieval medicine always intrigued me. I began by working at Wellcome, the big pharmaceutical company of the 1970s. It's since merged with GlaxoSmithKline. But I was working in medical research with them and really got interested in the advances in medical science. But because of my historical interests, I also like to look back, wondering how much the people of the past might have got right. And of course, the horrible things that they weren't so correct on. Because I'd done my original qualifications in science, I went back and did the Open University, and I did the history of medicine, which I found fascinating, and then went on to do my master's by research. I did my master's with the Wellcome Library in London, which studies the history of medicine. It's actually connected to the people I worked for originally, the Wellcome Foundation. And I studied a particular manuscript dated to 1454 that was written for a medical practitioner of some kind, and I transcribed it all, and it was an intriguing manuscript, and that was how I got my master's degree. So that is really the history of my interest in medical history.
Wonderful. Okay. And your book, Medieval Medicine, Its Mysteries and Science, was published in 2016. So you've told us a bit about how you became interested in that area through your work. Tell us a little bit about this book. What's it all about?
Well, I did want to cover a broader spectrum, really, than medieval medicine.
Right.
So I looked right back to the ancient Greek, which was just what medieval doctors were doing. They were still studying ancient texts from Greece and Rome. If they went to university, they were taught all about Hippocrates, Aristotle, and a guy called Galen, who was a surgeon to the gladiators in ancient Rome. So a lot of their ideas had been around for centuries. When people converted to Christianity, all these ancient sources had all been pagans, and there was a bit of difficulty in putting a Christian slant on it. There's actually a poem written in the 14th century which makes Aristotle and Galen and Hippocrates and other ancients sort of honorary Christians. It wasn't their fault they were born before Christ.
Right.
So they didn't have the opportunity to be Christians. But had Christ been born earlier, they would definitely have been Christian. But Christianity also brought in another difficulty, which was that illness was seen as God's punishment for your sins. So there were churchmen in particular who thought it was a bad idea for a physician to try to alleviate pain or cure a problem, because he was endangering the patient's soul, because God was punishing him. He was also endangering his own soul by going against God's will. So that was one problem. But others thought, well, if there is a cure, or at least a method of alleviating symptoms. At the time, it was usually plant-based. God must have created those plants with the objective that man would use them. So not to treat the patient was also going against God's will. So you can see how medicine in the early days was very controversial.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'd love to hear, you've touched on this a little bit, but I'd love to hear about how medieval medicine developed. You've mentioned those classical texts. So what did these early physicians and apothecaries believe about the body and illness? You've touched a little bit in this area, but let's delve a little bit further. And where did they derive this knowledge from?
Well, I think Stone Age people probably discovered that this plant or that plant, if they chewed it, helped their headache or whatever. So most of it originally was trial and error. And of course, if you took too much of some plants, well, you might not get better at all.
Yeah, that's right.
So originally, it was just trial and error, and certain people concentrated, witch doctors we might call them, on methods of alleviating illnesses. But gradually it became more structured. The Anglo-Saxons were very good at medicine in many ways, and I'll talk about that a bit more later. They called their doctors Leech. So anyone with the surname Leech was probably come from a family of doctors originally. But when we think of leeches, we think of those little slug-like things that might attach themselves to you if you wade through water. Nasty blood-sucking things. But they were used medicinally, and such an extent that the Anglo-Saxons called them leeches. They were actually calling them doctors.
Right, okay.
So men or women could act as medical practitioners, perhaps mixing potions. It was always a bit risky because if your potions didn't work, they might accuse you of witchcraft and sorcery and that sort of thing. But into the 1100s, there was a shortage of educated priests. So the church set up universities, and they were originally just for training men for the priesthood. But eventually the universities branched out to teach law and medicine as well. But of course, because it was university, all students, when they began to qualify, would have to take holy orders, which made them sort of minor priests. And women couldn't be priests, so women could not go to university. And then, in a terrible year for the medical profession, in 1215, at a Lateran Council meeting, the Pope decided that too many of his priests and bishops were going to war. So he came out with a new rule that any man of the church could not spill so much as a drop of blood. That immediately meant that no university-trained physician could do surgery because he would spill blood. And that was how surgeons became quite separate from physicians. Surgeons did not train at university. They trained as apprentices to someone who was already handy with a scalpel and a sewing needle and whatever else was necessary. So that actually meant women could be surgeons, though there were never very many of them. In your questions, you also asked about the apothecaries.
Yes, the apothecaries.
Well, they were our They were the pharmacists of the day, and they would mix the potions, make the ointments, which were prescribed by the physicians, who weren't expected to get their hands dirty actually making medicines. So the apothecaries came up with a completely different route because they became associated with the Grocers Guild, because the grocers were the ones who imported foreign herbs and spices and weird and wonderful ingredients. And in fact, the apothecaries in London were still regulated by the Grocers Guild right up until after Tudor times.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I hope that answers your...
Yes, it does, yeah, because a lot of the time, obviously, if you read texts from the time, you know, you hear the word physician, apothecary, surgeon, and it's good to, I think, have a good understanding of what the differences were with those different roles, I suppose. Now, you've talked a little bit about the formal training for physicians and the way that barber surgeons would get there via an apprenticeship. What about in Tudor times? How did medical education develop throughout the Tudor reign?
Well, sadly, Tudor doctors hadn't really advanced very much at all. They were still taught Hippocrates, Aristotle, and the rest. But as I've said, the surgeons were quite separate, and they were far more practical. And here they were beginning to make advances. Battlefield surgeons were learning a lot about how the human body was put together. Christian tradition was that you didn't chop up dead bodies to have a look and see how they worked. Anatomy lessons were 90% theory. So they knew very little about the internal structure of the body, but simply because they were stitching up injured soldiers, surgeons did get to learn rather more anatomy, and some of them were pretty advanced. Going back just before the Tudor period, a big advance was made by an English surgeon, John Bradmore. At the Battle of Shrewsbury in 1403, Prince Hal, who would later be the famous Henry V of Agincourt, fought his first battle, and he actually received a nasty injury. He got an arrow in his cheek, ouch, which went right through to the top of his palate. It was well embedded and alongside his nose. So John Bradmore had the shaft of the arrow cut off, but he still had to get point of the arrow out without causing further damage, and it had to be a clean job. You couldn't afford to leave any bits behind in the wound. And John invented there and then on the spot a very special pair of forceps, which he had a blacksmith make up to his design, and he used it. It was rather like a pair of pincers, but you could open out the two sides, slide them into the wound over the arrowhead, tighten them up, and then pull it out in one go. A friend of mine actually did an experiment for a Channel 4 program in which she had this special forceps constructed, and they tested it on a pig carcass. Now, Bradmore went on to pack the wound with barley mixed with honey, the honey being antiseptic and antibiotic, and he writes exactly what treatments he gave the prince, and the prince lived quite another day. But it's quite interesting, if you look at the portraits of Henry V, he's the only King of England whose portraits are in profile.
Right.
And I think that might be because his other cheek that you can't see is a bit scarred and messy due to this horrible injury. So that was a bit prior to the Tudors. But in the 16th century, we have a French surgeon again practicing on the battlefield. His name was Ambrose Paré. And he heard of an old wives' tale about onion skins being good for treating burns. Now, into the Tudor period, they were starting to use firearms, handguns, and you lit the gunpowder and then fired the gun. But the gunpowder could be quite close to your face. And if it misfired, your hands, your face could be received nasty burns. And Paré decided to test this old wives' tale about onion skins being good for burns. And it worked because the onion skin excluded the air. Onions also have antiseptic and antibiotic properties, and the cure worked really well. So he wrote all of that up. He did have some very odd ideas as well, but rather gruesome. Now, Paré went on to become surgeon to the French king, Henri II, and then to his son, Francois II, who married Mary Queen of Scots in 1558. So he actually became royal surgeon. But even he couldn't save Francis when he died of something which sounds very like meningitis just 18 months after becoming king. And that's when Mary returned to Scotland and all the trouble started.
Yes, that's right. A lot of
advances being made, yes, but not drastic.
Okay, that was so interesting. I'd never heard of the onion skins being used, so that's really great. So, Tony, you mentioned that women obviously couldn't be physicians because they couldn't attend university, but you did say that some could become barber surgeons or surgeons. Is there any other way that women could play a role in the world of Tudor medicine? I know we talked quite a bit about midwives last time, so how else could they involve themselves in this area?
Well, the head of every household, every housewife, was free to make her own ointments, skin treatments, and headache remedies. There was nothing to stop them doing that. And in fact, it was expected that the housewife would have remedies at her fingertips. But as I said, in medieval times, they could train as surgeons. They could also train as apothecaries, because that didn't require university training either. But unfortunately, Tudor legislation really does reduce women's opportunities. The reason for that was unemployment. In Tudor England, the kings, Henry VII, Henry VIII, were not keen on spending money on war, so armies were reduced. Landowners had also worked out that if they enclosed their farmland and had huge flocks of sheep, that was a very good way of making a lot of money, and you didn't have to pay many labourers except at shearing time to care for the sheep. And unemployment, because of fewer works on the land, fewer men in the army, plus the population was finally recovering from the levels it had been reduced to by the Black Death. There were a lot of fit, healthy men out of work. So Tudor legislation was passed saying that no employer should employ a woman if there was a man available to do the job. They did like employing women because women came cheaper, but now women were virtually put out of any sort of professional job. A wife could help her husband, a daughter could probably help her father, but they weren't really allowed to employ outsiders. So women's opportunities were very reduced. The only other area for women was the unofficial role of village wise woman. And a woman would often train her daughter to succeed her, teaching her all about the local herbs, where to find them, how to collect them and what to do with them. But as I mentioned earlier, if things went wrong, the Tudor period, people were getting very wary of witchcraft. The village wise woman was always at risk.
Yeah, sounds like a bit of a dangerous, risky job for the time. All right, thank you. So we've mentioned the physicians again. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of the royal physician. You've said that these are obviously university trained, but that they probably didn't have the same kind of experience as the surgeon, which you've already mentioned, and the hands-on practical experience. So what was the role of the royal physician?
Well, we don't know an awful lot about what the royal physicians have been doing. Tudor times, the records are better. We do know a little bit more. We know they were paid an annual salary, which required them to treat the whole household as required, not just the king. They were also obliged to travel with the king and go to war if the king commanded. We know that Henry VII had a liking for Italian doctors. There was a good reason for that. The Italian universities produce more medical men than Oxford and Cambridge ever did. I think throughout the whole 15th century, there weren't 10 Oxford and Cambridge trained doctors. So you really did have to go abroad. And Henry VII employed a Genoese physician and astrologer. The two studies usually went together. A physician would study the stars because the heavens were thought to affect health. Well, in fact, it affected everything. It was quite usual to go to a physician and ask him to draw up your horoscope before you set out on a journey, or draw up the horoscope of your bride-to-be to see if she would be a good wife and how many children she would give you and whether she would outlive you or whether you would outlive her. They even used astrologers to find lost items. They thought that if your favourite ring went missing, a physician could check whether it had been stolen or whether it was just lost out the back of the sofa. Now, we do know that Henry VIII granted a charter to the Royal College of Physicians in 1518, which made the whole medical business a little more professional. But one reason why it's very difficult to discover exactly what these royal physicians did and what treatments they prescribed for the sovereign was because it was considered an act of treason to forecast the monarch's death. And even rumours of their less than perfectly robust good health were punishable offences. And because royal illnesses were always hushed up as far as possible, we not only don't know what kings and queens suffered from, we don't know how they were treated. So it's only the most severe, when they thought the monarch was about to die, such as when Queen Elizabeth I caught smallpox in 1562, do we even know that the monarch was definitely ill. We know that Henry VIII suffered accidents in the joust. that was public, so they couldn't hush it up. But really, to make the monarch's state of health public was an act of treason, so it was all kept quiet, which is why we don't know an awful lot about what royal physicians did.
Okay, thank you. So we're imagining that if a member of the royal family or the nobility becomes ill, they have royal physicians at court that can attend on them. And let's talk about the ordinary Tudor person for a moment. If they become ill or disease, you know, strikes the family down, you've mentioned a couple of sort of avenues that they had already. Obviously, the housewife would have some treatments up her sleeve, or the village wise woman as well. What else could they do if there's illness in the family?
Well, the very first thing you did was always the cheapest. You prayed.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you'd committed a sin, they still thought sin was often the cause of an illness, and God forgave you, then you'd recover. So prayer was always the first result. But by Tudor times, there were some do-it-yourself medical books now being written and printed in English for the laymen to read. If you couldn't read the book and you were too poor to pay a professional, yeah, then the local wise woman or your wife, if you trusted her, were probably the best option. One problem is that if you lived out in the countryside, a physician was probably not available. Physicians like to earn a good salary, so they practiced in the larger towns and cities where there were enough wealthy patients that they could make a living. Out in the countryside, your best chance was to find an itinerant doctor. They often had another job alongside their medical duties. Towards the end of the 15th century, for example, a guy called John Crophill was a bailiff for Wicks Priory in Essex, and he treated the carpenter, the cowman, the blacksmith and the sexton just for a few pence, while doing his rounds, collecting the rents for the priory. So that was how he managed to make a living. So it was possible to get semi-professional treatment. And John Crophill kept a notebook, which is how we know about him, in which he detailed how much he charged his patients and what he treated them for. And I think his treatments must have been pretty good. His notebook covers about 30 years, and the blacksmith, who's mentioned on page one, dies of old age at the very end of the book, and he crops up quite a bit. So I think John Crophill must have treated him successfully.
All right, so there were many diseases, Tony, that afflicted people in the 16th century, and you already mentioned one major one, which was smallpox. There was also the deadly and the feared sweating sickness, as we sort of call it, which could kill its victims within hours. So what do we know of this really nasty disease?
Well, it does seem to be almost specifically Tudor. First epidemic occurred in the autumn of 1485, just after Henry Tudor had won the Battle of Bosworth. And it was actually said that it was his French troops who brought the illness to this country. I've studied a number of wills from the autumn of 1485 in London, and there's a whole series of wills of fishmongers who are all neighbours. And the first one that died, he doesn't say he's got the sweating sickness, but he names his two neighbours, who are both fishmongers, as his executors. But then both the executors write wills naming each other, and it goes on, and then the four fishmongers names his wife as his executor, and the same names are in these four wills, so it seems all four men died within 3 weeks of each other, and I would think they were probably victims of the sweating sickness. There were five epidemics with high mortality rates and a milder outbreak in 1506. It's actually thought that Anne Boleyn caught it in 1528 during that outbreak, and she survived. But Henry Brandon, who was the Duke of Suffolk, was not so lucky. He died in the outbreak of 1551. Your earlier quote, Natalie, about people dying within 2 hours comes from a book written by the physician John Keyes. He said that symptoms included headache, giddiness and lethargy, then drenching sweat, severe headache, breathlessness and delirium with a rapid pulse. Some died within 2 hours. As Keyes put it, merry at dinner and dead at supper. Now, those who survived 24 hours usually recovered, but it was no guarantee that you wouldn't catch the same disease again, unlike measles, where if you catch it, you're then immune. I'm afraid with this ailment, you could catch it again. Now, it used to be thought that the sweat was a form of very virulent flu, a bit like the Spanish flu of 1918. But its occurrence is rather unlike flu, in that the epidemics occurred in the summer and early autumn. Cold weather would end the outbreak, and we know today that flu tends to be a winter complaint. So the timing of the outbreaks, the rapid onset of symptoms, and in particular the breathlessness, which we now know resulted from fluid filling up the lungs, and that was the usual cause of death, are actually typical symptoms of something called hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, or HPS. Now, this is a very unusual disease, but it made headlines in the United States in 1993, and its symptoms do fit the sweating sickness profile, so that may have been what it is. But fortunately, 1551 was the last occurrence, really, and then it just disappeared, which was good.
Tony, today we're bombarded with advice, and you know, on how to remain healthy, what to eat, what not to eat, what to drink, what not to drink. What advice did the medical experts of the Tudor period, or the late medieval Tudor period, give people in regards to staying healthy and preventing illness?
Well, we're very fortunate to have an English physician called Andrew Baird in 1542. Wrote his Dietary of Health, and he wrote in English so everyone could read and understand. Now, they were quite modern in their outlook, in that physicians looked at the whole body. It was a holistic approach, and diet was seen as the best preventive as well as the best treatment for a lot of complaints. So Andrew Baird gave instructions of how to stay healthy by what you ate. We might argue against his instructions that salad and fresh fruit should be avoided at all costs. He says an Englishman should eat beef, but from a bull, not a cow. It was always thought that the female animal gave inferior meat. That went right across the board for everything. Just as a little aside, it was even thought that if your child had to be breastfed by a wet nurse, you should choose a woman who'd given birth to a boy because they produce better milk for boys than they did for girls.
Right.
So I'm afraid, sex came into it everywhere. So also, the meat you eat, we would agree, should not be too salty. An Englishman should drink ale, never beer, according to Andrew Board. Beer being ale plus hops, because beer makes you fat. As an example, he says, look how fat-bellied beer-drinking Dutchmen are. And apologies to any Dutch listening for that. He said, water down your wine if you like, but never drink water alone unless it's fresh rainwater. Milk is only good for babies and the sick and not for grown men. And the same is true of butter, which is for children, not grown men. Fish is good, but anyone with asthma should avoid it, along with dust, smoke, nuts, and cheese. And no milk for asthmatics either. But he does say a good cook is half a physician. The best medicines come from the kitchen, so the doctor and the cook should work together. A good diet meant a healthy life, but unfortunately, as we know, late in Elizabeth's reign, Walter Raleigh brought tobacco back to England from the Americas, and doctors began prescribing it, either chewed or smoked, as a preventive and, in fact, a cure for many ailments, including cancer. So there you are. Elizabeth I didn't like smoking. She disapproved. But James I wrote a book in 1604 called Counterblast to Tobacco, in which he calls it a noxious weed and says no one should smoke it. But his counselors pointed out how much money the crown made on the customs duties paid on importing tobacco leaves, and after that he shut up. Yeah, his coffers were more important than his subjects' health.
All right, Tony. Well, it's always quite fun to hear about some weird and wonderful medical practices and treatments. It makes us feel better, I think. So, could you tell us about some of these that existed in the 16th century?
Well, that Ambrose Paré, he might well have been a very skilled surgeon, but he still had some weird ideas. And I suggest that any animal lovers now cover their ears.
Oh dear.
A recipe of his for a salve to soothe wounds involved boiling two newborn puppies alive in oil
Oh
of lilies, drowning a pound weight of earthworms in white wine, and then combining and boiling the two together before straining the liquid and adding turpentine and a dash of aqua vitae, which would be distilled alcohol, in the French case, probably brandy. And that was meant to be a good treatment for wounds.
Oh,
But
goodness.
but there were treatments that really worked. For example, meadow sweet was a favourite herbal remedy, and meadow sweet actually contains a kind of aspirin derivative, so it's brilliant for fevers and headaches. So that was pretty good. And in fact, aspirin, the very name, comes from the old Latin word for meadow sweet, which was spirea. So that's actually where the word aspirin comes from. But unlike manufactured aspirin, meadow sweet is much kinder to the stomach. and was actually used as a stomach medicine as well. Then we have dragon's blood, which is still used in Tudor times. It sounds very mythological.
It does, yes.
But in fact, it was the sap from a tree which in medieval times grew in Sicily and the Canary Islands and various other warm Mediterranean places. Now, if the tree, it's called Draconis, which actually comes from the word dragon, if the bark of this tree is damaged, the tree oozes a bright red sap, which sets like a scab over the injury. And for the benefit of the tree, it contains antibiotic, antiseptic, antiviral elements, so that the tree doesn't get infected. And this was imported as a resin, chopped up into a powder, and could be taken as a medicine. It was even used as a paint, because of its bright red colour. But if you sort of pasted it on a wound, it would set to make a film, protective film, over the wound. And by the time it fell off, your wound should have healed. So sort of a Tudor sticking plaster, but with curative components. There's also one brilliant remedy that went right back to Anglo-Saxon times, but the manuscript's still around in Tudor times, but we don't know how much it was used. But it was compiled by Alfred the Great's personal physician, a guy called Bald, and one of Bald's remedies was for a sty on the eye, very painful infection. And he said it had to be prepared in advance using onions, leeks, vinegar, wine, various other things, all mixed together in a brass dish and left for 9 days to ferment and work. And then you could brush it onto the sty with a feather. Now, in 2015, the University of Nottingham English Department transcribed some of the remedies from Bald's book from Old English so that we could understand it better. And their clinical department decided to give one particular remedy, this one for the sty, a go and make the remedy as best they could, which they did, and they tested it in the laboratory on MRSA, both in mice and in petri dishes. And they tried it on all sorts of ailments and viruses and bacteria, and it cured MRSA. So it should definitely have cured styes on eyes. So some of the remedies were pretty wonderful.
Yes, I know. It's amazing that they could get some things so right and other things, like the poor puppies, so terribly wrong. It's, goodness me. All right, so when do we find that medicine sort of moves away from the classical teachings and becomes a more science-based? When does that take place?
Well, it was a very, very slow process.
Yes.
A Dr. William Harvey, as an Englishman, he was born in 1578. He qualified in Italy and became royal physician to James I and Charles I. Now, he worked out that the heart pumped blood all round the body. The old idea had been was that blood ebbed and flowed like the tide, but Harvey worked out that it didn't happen like that. Blood only went in one direction, it never reversed the flow. But when he put his ideas in the public domain in his book in 1628. Many of his patients deserted him and went to other doctors, thinking that Harvey must be a complete crackpot. And many of his fellow physicians agreed. Things hadn't got much better in the reign of Charles II when the poor king became ill in February 1685. It seemed to be a slight ailment, but he had 14 royal physicians, and it seems that every single one of them wanted to try their favourite remedy on him. And many of the remedies would have counteracted each other or even antagonised each other. And when Charles died after 5 days of sheer torture, it was actually said that he died of a surfeit of physicians. Still not very good. But in 1747, a guy called James Lind invented the first ever clinical trial in attempting to find a cure for scurvy. And that's really the first step towards scientific clinical practice. But we also lost things such as a medieval anaesthetic called Dwale, which could put a patient to sleep while he was operated on, and dragon's blood and things like that were completely lost. But a few of these have been rediscovered, like willow bark, which also contains aspirin, was rediscovered as a cure in 1763. So really it's not until the 18th century that medicine really begins to move away from the ancient sources. It was a very, very slow process.
Yes, it sounds like that. And I'm you know, I love the past and I love history, but I'm so grateful to live in a period where we have a little bit better understanding about medicine and access to medicine is yes, I'm very grateful for that. So Tony, I think you probably remember from the last time that we chatted that I like to end by playing what I call a little game of 10 to go. So 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better. But actually, before we do that, tell me about your new book or new edition of your book that's about to come out.
Yes, on the 15th of this month, a book that I wrote a couple of years ago finally comes out in paperback. It's called A Year in the Life of Medieval England, and it contains an entry for 366 days of the year. It's something that happened on that particular date throughout the period from 1066 up until, I think it's 1500 I was allowed to go. And often it's got a big event, if there was a battle or a coronation. But the bits I find more interesting were the dates when I couldn't find any big event. And I often put in a remedy for an ailment that might have occurred around that time of year, or a recipe for a seasonal dish, or even songs and poetry and letters and all sorts of things occur throughout the book. And it was a bit expensive as a hardback, but already all my free copies from the publisher that I get prior to publication, they went like hotcakes as paperback. So I think I can dare to recommend that.
Well, I think I can recommend it as well. That sounds brilliant. I'm going to go and add it to my shopping basket after we chat. I love learning about that, the nitty-gritty of everyday life. And I think lots of people are fascinated by that stuff as well. So that sounds brilliant. Now, let's go with our 10 to go, Tony. So number one, what is something you love about where you live?
I love my library. Oh. And I love my garden. My husband's really got into gardening this year, and we've got a wildlife garden. And as I said to you, I can watch squirrels and birds and all sorts, and it's rather lovely.
Oh, that does sound absolutely lovely. Now, talking about libraries, what's a book that's on your to-be-read list at the moment?
My to-be-read list. Let's see if I can remember. I'm reading M.C. Beaton's Hamish Macbeth series at the moment, which is all about they're whodunit novels, but set in the Highlands of Scotland, which
Oh,
I'm
that sounds
rather
awesome.
enjoying.
Yeah, that sounds good. I like that. Sounds atmospheric.
Yes. Scenery's good as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you like to garden and you like to look at the wildlife there. What do you like? What else do you like to do in your spare time?
Mainly writing. I do like writing short stories for fun, that sort of thing. But we also rather like Formula One motor racing.
Ah, there
You
you
can't get
go.
much more modern than that. Yes, we went to the British Grand Prix in the summer. Had a wonderful time.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, Tony, do you have a favourite season?
Oh, it's got to be early summer when there are more flowers, all the beautiful woodland flowers, and you're looking forward to the roses, and the weather's warming up, and the days are getting longer. I always feel a bit sad at this time of year, seeing the beautiful trees drop their leaves and the flowers fading. So
Yeah.
yeah, I love spring and early summer.
Now, what's one of your most treasured possessions?
A ring for
Okay.
our 40th wedding anniversary.
Oh, wow.
Glenn bought me a ring. Your 40th is your ruby anniversary,
Right, okay.
and he bought me a beautiful ring which had an opal in the middle, because an opal was my engagement ring, surrounded by little rubies. It had to be refitted three times. It's been lost. It's
Oh
been
dear.
recovered. But that's one of my most treasured possessions.
Oh.
But another was more recent. Last Christmas, I had a rather special birthday. I won't say which one. But my sons got together and commissioned a portrait of the hero of my medieval novels.
Oh, that's amazing.
And he's hanging on the wall opposite now, and that's got to be a treasured possession. My sons went to so much trouble, commissioned it from the artist who did an original little picture for a bookmark to go with the novels. And so Sebastian Foxley's sitting there looking at them.
Oh, that's fantastic. They are two very wonderful possessions, I think. So, this next question was actually suggested by one of our listeners, and she suggested that I ask if you could bring someone to our modern times from Tudor times, maybe to show them something or just to have them here for a while. Who would you like to bring?
Perhaps Jane Grey,
Oh,
Lady
okay.
Jane Grey. I'd warn her of what
Yes. Oh.
lay ahead. Don't try to be queen, you'll regret it. But I do think she was a very well-educated, very intelligent young woman.
Absolutely.
I'd quite like to get to know her a bit.
Yes, I think there'd be very interesting discussions there, that's for sure. So, Tony, do you have a signature dish that you're known for? Maybe something you take to parties or when people come over, that kind of thing?
Me, I'm the worst cook. Yeah, cooking isn't really my thing. But when the family come, and you need a big dish, I do an old favourite for my boys, which is chicken pilaf. just chicken and rice baked in the oven, but with all sorts of nuts and spices mixed in with it. That seems to go down quite well.
Yeah, that sounds delicious. Very hearty meal. That's great. So tell me, what's your ideal Sunday consist of? What do you like to do then?
Well, if there's a Grand Prix running, I like to watch that. Sundays, I really treat like the rest of the week. I'm as likely to work on Sunday if the mood takes me. Otherwise, I'll put my feet up, perhaps out on the patio, read a book.
Lovely. Yeah, well, when you enjoy your work so much, why not, I suppose? That's exactly. What's a historic house that you enjoy visiting?
I think one of the most atmospheric is a place called Minster Lovell in Oxfordshire.
Yes.
It's a complete ruin, but it belonged to Francis Lovell, who was Richard III's chamberlain and a good friend. And if you go there is something about the place. It's a beautiful ruin. It's on a little river, Windrush, which usually has few swans swimming up and down. It's a beautiful place, but those walls have stories to tell.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree with you. Yeah, I was able to visit, it was many years ago now, but it was quite a rainy sort of greyish day and it was incredibly atmospheric.
Yeah, a bit spooky.
Yes, a bit spooky, exactly. All right, lucky last, Tony, what's something that you're currently looking forward to?
Well, we're off to America at the end of next week. Glenn retires next Thursday.
Oh, wow.
And on the Friday, we're off flying to Boston. We're going to go up into the Catskill Mountains and look at the fall colour. Got a cabin on a creek, which looks out on a nature reserve on the other side. And then it's a train all the way to New York for a couple of days, taking in a Broadway show.
Well, that just sounds perfect, doesn't it? Wonderful. I hope you have a fantastic time there. Now, before I let you go, you probably have some packing and preparations to do, but before I can let you go, the very last thing is our Tudor takeaway. Do you happen to have another Tudor takeaway for us, Tony?
Well, earlier I mentioned Bold's wonderful recipe that can cure MRSA. And if readers want to look that up, they can do www.nottingham.ac.uk/news. And its press release is 2015 March, Ancient Biotics. And all the bit about how they did the experiments and finding the remedy for a modern day superbug is all there. So that's Bold's recipe.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a new one for our Tudor takeaway. So I love that. And I'll make sure I add the link to the show notes and that makes it easier for people to locate it. But that sounds really fascinating. Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Tony, for chatting and talking Tudors with me again. It's been such a wonderful pleasure. I hope you have an amazing time on your trip. And who knows, I might be able to lure you back to talking Tudors one day in the future.
Yeah, hopefully I won't have a cough and a croak.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.